This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the massacre in Santa Barbara prompts a national discussion about sex, mental illness, and violence. Also, a new plan to save Detroit by tearing down a third of its buildings. I'm David Block.
And I'm Julia Turner. On this week's Culture GabFest, the 9/11 Museum. After all the years of hype and controversy, does it do what it's supposed to? Then, what makes for a good commencement speech? And then, HBO's The Normal Heart tries to remind us how the early days of the AIDS epidemic felt to those living through it.
Have you told them there there's an epidemic going on?
Says who?
The government.
Which government? What, our government? An epidemic.
The Centers for Disease Control declared it
17 months ago.
You can't not know this!
Could you please reduce your level of hysteria?
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Elliot Rodger's Santa Barbara killing spree has incited a tremendous debate about sex and violence. Was Rodger, a hateful, troubled young man, an anomaly, or does he represent an America seething with misogynist violence? And then Detroit is a wasteland of ghost buildings and vacant lots. There's an ambitious new plan to save it by tearing down the ruins. Can it possibly succeed? I'm joined today by Emily Bazelon, Slate senior editor. She's in New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David.
And John Dickerson is traveling, so I'm joined in Washington by Jake Tapper, host of CNN's afternoon show, The Lead. Hello, Jake.
Hey, David.
Elliot Rodger's killing spree in Santa Barbara has prompted intense debates about sexual violence, about mental illness and violence, and about the sexist, loathsome manosphere culture that both fascinated and rejected Rodger. One thing that has not prompted, however, is an intense debate about guns. So, Emily, women were among his victims. He was full of hateful misogyny. Why has this particular mass murder prompted such a discussion about that in ways that other mass murders have not?
Well, Elliot Rodger was really clear that he saw himself as this unfortunate virgin, that the fact that women had sexually rejected him was at the bottom of all of his obsessions. It was the way in which his mental illness played out, was to obsess about this. He wrote about wanting to put women in concentration camps. I mean, it's really ugly. It's almost like a cartoon of a sexually frustrated 22-year-old. In a way that I both kind of can't believe he was so overt and clear, and also I can't believe that we haven't seen this before, because it almost feels like overdetermined that all this rage about sexual rejection and women and confused ideas about masculinity would erupt into violence. And I guess the thing that I think is different about this is the abstracted nature of the violence. So there are lots of men who get incredibly angry with specific women and kill and hurt those women. That's common. It's part of domestic violence. But to have someone then kill essentially just any old woman. So he went and knocked on the door of a sorority at UCSB. And then when no one answered the door, he just killed two women on the street. There's something really scary about
that.
And
then how about the fact that four of his victims were men?
Yes, exactly. And four of his victims were men, including his roommates. So I think there's also some way in which he was angry with the men who were sexually active and he wasn't, or some way in which this outlet of rage against women was maybe not all of what
Emily, just going back. I mean, we have had tons of killers. We have killers who've targeted prostitutes. You have people what's the guy in Cleveland who locked up all these women. It's not like there
Castro.
Have not been
Castro.
There have not. It's not like we have a shortage of crazed, psychopathic, horrible men committing terrible acts of violence specifically aimed at women. And in fact, as Jake points out, I mean, most of the victims who died were in fact men. Why is this one the one that grabs people, or that grabs a certain set of women in a way that when prostitutes are murdered, it doesn't?
Well, maybe we should have the same response when prostitutes are murdered. But I think the manifesto is so specific in its rage against women, but also it's about womankind. It's not specific women with whom he had a relationship with, which is what we're used to hearing about. Although when you think of men, you know, serial killers going after prostitutes, there is a similarity there. And maybe just unfortunately, we're not as moved by the plight of prostitutes because it seems other and see me in a way that the idea of these college girls walking around and these college men getting mowed down feels like it could happen to anyone.
So, Jake, do you think it's like it's a useful lens to look at him through the lens of misogyny, or is it only this is a crazy person?
I think first and foremost, he obviously was severely emotionally disturbed, and whether he had grasped onto misogyny or racism or whatever, this kid had serious problems. And what disturbs me beyond his actions and his twisted thoughts is the fact that it seems like this was preventable. His mother had called the police after seeing some of his disturbing YouTube postings. 7 Santa Barbara police deputies or sheriff deputies went to his apartment, talked to him. Not surprisingly, given that he was able to hide his illness from a lot of people. In terms of the misogyny, what I suspect is that his twisted thoughts and his feelings of entitlement ring a bell with a lot of women out there who have felt hostility not just from the frat boys and the football players on college campuses, but also from the so-called geeks and dorks who think, hey, I'm a nice guy. How come I'm not entitled to have sex with you? And I think that probably touches a lot of women emotionally, apparently from the Yes All Women hashtag success.
So, Jake, you've been in Washington for 20 years covering politics, and each time we have one of these killings, there is this sense that, oh, something will change in the way we talk about guns or mental illness or both. And since, I think, Carolyn McCarthy and the Long Island killing, which was 20 years ago, that has not been the case.
No.
Basically, it has gone in the other way. Is there anything about this killing that makes you think, oh, maybe there will be a change from this one?
I think there are two reasons why it won't. One is that half the killings were done with a knife or knives. His two roommates and a friend visiting were killed by knives. And the second one is that California has some of the strictest gun control laws in the nation. Where I think there should be room for some sort of exploration is specifically in the access to weapons among individuals who are mentally disturbed or showing problems of mental disturbance, and also people who have drug and alcohol problems. The way that society right now looks at people is very binary in terms of their mental health. Either they are fine and free, or they have been adjudicated by a court of law to be a danger to themselves or others. And as Emily's referring to, there's talk of there being more of like some sort of middle ground where weapons might be more of a question. Now, I think California already has some laws in that middle ground, but they're talking about expanding and making them more aggressive. The big problem is that we don't have a mental health system to deal with these people. Obviously, the way that we, when all three of us were kids, there were hospitals. There was a National Health Service in this country. There were mental hospitals. And where most of these patients are now are the streets or jail or dead, because we don't, as a society, have a system for mental illness the way we do for physical illness.
I mean, I just want to add to that that there's a reason we got away from the old system, which is to make more room for outpatient treatment, and because we have better medication than we had in the, you know, 70s or 60s. That is not to say that you're not right and that we don't have this big problem, especially with using prison as essentially like the de facto mental health services, especially for people who don't have resources. It's so torturous for the families of people who are mentally ill, because on the one hand, you fear taking away the freedom of someone who you're going to make completely miserable, maybe for no real reason. And I think a lot of families question themselves, how much are they willing to take care of their family members? How much is this somehow only their responsibility? But then the flip side of this is this question of danger and whether the law gives you enough power when you really feel in your gut something is wrong, as Elliot Rogers's mother does. And I really hope California passes this restraining order law and tries this kind of method, because it's exactly the sort of experiment that we want the states to try so we can see if having this approach makes sense. I mean, we should also say that most mentally ill people are not violent. What there is a connection between is mental illness and these mass shootings that we are all understandably pretty obsessed by.
Let me go back now to this misogyny question. There's this moment of anger about sexual assault. We've seen it at what's happening on college campuses. We've seen a huge amount of discussion about this issue. The Yes All Women hashtag has obviously taken off. There's concern about poisonous speech towards women. I think the trigger warnings are another aspect of this, this idea that there is a lot of kind of intrinsic violence in the way we're talking about women in the culture now. Does this reflect, is it there actually more violence towards women in the culture, or is it that as women have gained an economic power, they have an ability to speak out about it in a way that they didn't?
Well, there's no way that violence against women is increasing. If you compared it to, you know, decades or 100 years ago, you would see like incredibly upsetting kinds of an extent of violence against women. But there is the internet, which makes all this, the ugliness, at least the speech part of it, very visible.
But the ugliness is towards everyone, Emily. The poison, there's poison, as you guys were talking before the show, there is poison towards everyone.
Yeah, but the poison against women is specific. I mean, there are other kinds of specific poison, but it can be kind of brutal and assaultive in all these ways that, as you also said, women are very getting better at articulating and really calling to attention and feeling like part of feminism is airing all this and addressing it and making sure that we surface it as a cultural problem that everyone should be part of and aware of, and that men, who obviously most men are not in this scary category, that men are also thinking of it as a problem that's their problem, that's worth taking on, and not something that we just sort of shrug off and laugh off.
I think where I am concerned about the Yes All Women hashtag is the idea of this killer being some sort of poster boy for misogyny, because his kind of misogyny is so extreme, so out there, so easy for the average misogynist, the average sexist at on a college campus to distance himself from. He's nothing like this guy. And where the real problems are, and I agree with everything Emily just said, I think that it's not that there's been an increase of violence against women. There's just an increase of talking about it, fighting it, rebelling against it, talking about the idea that if you rape somebody, your punishment should be worse than just suspension for a semester. Where the work needs to be done is in educating regular guys, 18, 19-year-olds, about, in terms of the college campus situation, about what's appropriate, what's the way to look at women, what's the way to regard women, what's risky behavior when you're drunk, et cetera. And if you make Elliot Rodger the poster boy, that guy's not going to listen to you.
Mm-hmm. But the great thing about the Yes All Women hashtag is all the much more quotidian, mundane examples
Yes.
women are giving of, it's the guy who you have to say, I have a boyfriend, to get rid of him at a party, because just saying to him, I'm not interested, is, you don't think it's going to work. Or it's like the skeezy guy in the subway station who's like, anyway, there's so many small examples that I think a lot of women contend with all the time. I will say my fear about this is when it starts to verge into the very thin-skinned, because I feel like you also have to be a person in the world who can go through life and not let every insult and every bit of even harassment ruin your day. You have to be able to sometimes actually make fun of the things around you and just like keep on trucking. And so I do get a little bit worried that when women are super obsessed with victimhood, that they kind of give up too much of their own agency and let these men have too much power over their own emotions. You know, that old, I think it's Mae West saying that someone can only make you feel terrible if you let them. On the other hand, I always go back and forth, because I think the consciousness raising about this is really useful, and especially for some younger women, very powerful.
Coming up, can Detroit be saved? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and Jake Tapper, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. There is a remarkable new report out on blight in Detroit. The city's population has, of course, dropped from 2 million to about 700,000 over the last 50 years. It's in bankruptcy. It cannot keep its streetlights on. It can barely pay its cops. It has some of the worst schools in the United States. And it is attempting to figure out how to save itself. And one way it's thinking about trying to save itself is by changing how its land and buildings work and how it's changing its built environment. So the survey found that of about 380,000 parcels of land in the city, approximately a third of them were empty. Of the remainder of those that had buildings on it, about a third of those buildings were blighted, that were in a state of severe dilapidation, were abandoned, were burned down, were collapsed. In other words, if you kind of do some quick numbers on it, fully half of that city is gone. The estimate is that it would cost slightly less than $1 billion to clear out the blighted buildings and another billion or so to clear out the huge commercial structures, the big empty manufacturing plants that also dot and despoil the landscape in the city. So I just visited Detroit for the first time in my life. Have you guys been there?
Yeah.
Only the airport. Doesn't count. I've been to Flint.
It's sad.
It's
really
crazy.
Sad.
It is like I was struck. I was expecting, obviously, you read about the ruined porn and you read about how bad it is. But this sense, it is like no other environment I've ever seen.
It's despair, right? You walk down the street and you drive around and you just feel despair.
Or you don't feel anything because there's nobody there. Right. Like empty where there should be people and
but is it
weeds
empty,
where there
like
should be grass.
Missing teeth empty, in which case it gets really hard. How do you shrink the footprint? Or is it like, oh, well, there's obviously this whole... I can't imagine that it's like this whole square mile is gone.
Oh, it's like that. I mean, to me, the most striking area was this area. I think it's called Indian Village. I may have misremembered. I think it's Indian Village. Beautiful mansions. Beautiful, beautiful houses. Probably 4 blocks wide and 10 blocks deep, all beautiful houses. And then you go half a block off of it in any direction, completely blighted. It's this island of beauty and occupation in a sea of dilapidation and arson. And you feel like there's nothing to connect it to the rest of the world. Like, how can a city survive? How can this place survive if it doesn't have ligaments that join it to itself?
It's amazing is that we, we have a cabinet-level position called the Department of Housing and Urban Development. So somebody's job, and presumably thousands of federal employees, their job is to make sure that cities are okay. And yet we see cities die, and they don't die overnight. They die week by week, month by month, year by year. And the people in those cities are in a state of denial as citizens flee. Mayors and city council members promise that things are going to change. And then we watch them die. And Detroit is obviously a case study, but it's not alone. It's not the only city that this has happened to. It's just perhaps possibly the worst.
Well, that's one thing I wanted to get at was, do you guys think, is Detroit anomalous? Is it aberrational? The level of destruction and chaos there is so much greater than any place I've ever seen. Or is it just a particularly bad example of something which plagues us in lots of places?
I mean, I think there are a few other examples. Isn't Cleveland also plagued with some really high level of trouble? But to me, the other side of the story is that when I was growing up in the 80s in Philadelphia, it seemed like this was going to be true about Philadelphia. Certainly, we've had moments in New Haven.
The feeling that Philadelphia was dying was very tangible in the 80s. The difference is we didn't have, I mean, first of all, Detroit had an entire industry kind of die and then come back to life, but the auto industry. But Ed Rendell was a remarkable mayor. And we had 2 terms of a mayor who got Philadelphia back on its feet. And he did in Philadelphia what a lot of mayors were not able to do, which is negotiate tougher contracts with unions and attract business. And it's the reason he was ultimately elected governor of Pennsylvania. But I mean, we had sometimes, and this is something I learned when writing my book about Afghanistan, so it's weird talking about Philadelphia in that way, but sometimes history really does depend on the right leader at the right time, whether you're in a valley in Afghanistan or the city of Philadelphia.
I'm going to disagree with you. Okay. Not to say, I think there have been, the story of this period in American life will be the story of cities and the revival of American cities, and it's Rendell is an example. Obviously, Giuliani and Bloomberg in New York are the classic.
Baltimore?
Maybe. Rahm Emanuel in Chicago perhaps will be such a person. But I actually think you have to take into account physical geography, which is that what Philadelphia has, what New York City has, what Chicago has, what San Francisco has, what Seattle has, is a concentrated center. Mm-hmm. They have the center which can serve as gravity for a region. Detroit does not have that. The thing that struck me about Detroit is that it's a gigantic city. It's much bigger than it needs to be, given its population. Its footprint is too huge. Its streets are too wide. There's too much space. It's too hard to get from one place to another, and there are no good transportation networks. I mean, I guess there are roads, but besides, there are no buses that are good. There's no trains.
But that's bad leadership. I mean,
that was bad leadership.
But it's a city built from a different
era,
the era of the auto industry.
But that's right. But Emily has a good point. Like, you can't expect public transportation to thrive in a city that depends on cars. But yes, I'm not saying bad leadership now. I mean, I'm not blaming it on Dave Bing, but I mean, bad leadership for decades.
What I find confusing about Detroit is that the suburbs around Detroit are in great shape, right? So it's not like there isn't economic right. health and wherewithal in that area. It's that the city itself is too big and sprawling and unwieldy and then corrupt and plagued by all the pension plans it agreed to and has all these basic problems of flight and crime and disaster.
So last question. Should it be a national project to try to save Detroit?
I think that there is something to be said about how New Orleans managed the disaster of Katrina, and instead of trying to be exactly what they were before Katrina, they decided to try to manage what they were able to be. I think setting expectations low, you know, Detroit may never again be a city of 1.8 million residents. I think the idea of tearing down buildings and trying to improve what they're doing is healthy, and I don't know why it shouldn't be a federal priority.
What do you think, Emily?
I think that you have to be very cold-hearted and pragmatic about cities and the way in which they try to revive. And what happened in New Orleans, some of it was really painful and wrenching, and whole neighborhoods were abandoned, and there were people who felt incredibly dispossessed. My heart goes out to them, and I also think it can be completely necessary. There isn't some romantic idea in the sky that a city has to look the way it used to look or that it owes to its residents a continuing shape of their neighborhoods. It's sometimes you just have to reconstitute the whole thing. And then the tricky part is to actually do it right, because what we know about urban renewal over the years is that we often completely screw it up and make things worse instead of better.
That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture GabFest starts now.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Julia Turner. On this week's Slate Culture GabFest, The Normal Heart, HBO's new drama about the early days of the AIDS crisis. And then, commencement speeches. Is there a more vexatious literary form? Finally, the 9/11 Museum. How are we to feel about the museumification of a recent tragedy? Joining me today is Slate film critic Dana Stevens. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Julia.
And from Washington, D.C., our senior editor in the Culture Department, Dan Coyce. Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys.
Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Let's jump right in with The Normal Heart. The film is an adaptation of Larry Kramer's 1985 play about the early days of the AIDS crisis. It stars Mark Ruffalo as the Larry Kramer character, Ned Weeks, who's this incredibly caustic, enraged, loudmouth. Before actually we get to your response, let's quickly listen to a clip of the film.
Have you told them there's an epidemic going on?
Says who?
The government.
Which government? What, our government? An epidemic.
The Centers for Disease Control declared it
17 months ago.
You can't not know this. Could you please reduce your level of hysteria?
Certainly. New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, Boston, Denver, every single major American city is now showing cases. At least 25 foreign countries. But New York City, our home, the city that you have pledged to protect, has more than half of everything. Half the cases, half the dead. I know 57 of the dead ones. I don't want to know anymore. Now, when do we get to see the mayor? 14 months is a long time to be out to lunch.
You wait a minute.
No, you wait a minute. We can't. Time is not on our side.
It's hard to know what to do with a work like this that's sort of a hectoring, strident, propagandistic piece of agitprop that's also somewhat dated. And I feel like this is a period in the history of the AIDS crisis that in the last few years we've seen a lot of great documentaries about. We Were Here is one, How to Survive a Plague is another, and then on the fiction realm we've seen Angels in America and so many things that have revisited these early days of the AIDS crisis that I sort of feel like there needs to be something new being brought to light in this film. And to me, the subject matter of it and the style of presentation felt somewhat dated in that it was hectoring an audience that didn't necessarily need that hectoring anymore. I do think that Mark Ruffalo does a great job with this somewhat difficult to read role of the Larry Kramer stand-in character, Ned Weeks, where he's sort of painted as this perverse hero of the gay community. He's both a very respected figure that people listen to and someone that turns everyone off with his abrasiveness. And I think Ruffalo is good at getting that across. But there's something self-aggrandizing about the way the character is written by, you know, the person who's creating his self-portrait that to me made his motivations a little bit unclear and sort of made him into this singular hero in an epoch that, in fact, must have had many different activists organizing in different ways.
Coyce, what did you make of the film?
I guess I view this movie a little bit differently than you guys in that I view it as more or less like the essential document of that era, like the essential dramatic document. Like Angels in America is a great play, but it's a fantasia as opposed to anything attempting to be a documentary. And it's true that play is unbelievably self-aggrandizing for Larry Kramer. It's true that it's his side of things. But all that aside, I mean, all that included, in my opinion, I think that those things don't matter. I think that this is the one thing that people need to see or read or listen to understand what the community was like, to understand what the gay community in New York, and then by extension, as the disease spread throughout the world, was going through, the total paralyzing fear and the fact that very few people within the gay community were willing to take the disease on head first, and that essentially no one outside of the gay community was willing to take the disease seriously to the extent of halting research and underfunding policies that could have saved millions of lives.
Dan, you're right. I mean, we have to recognize the power of this film adaptation, or at least I do. I found it incredibly moving. But I haven't seen those other documentaries. Like, I was left with the question. I mean, Dan, you're saying this is the one thing you should watch. But I've sort of had in my queue of movies to see How to Survive a Plague. Obviously, we all talked about Dallas Buyers Club, which portrays an interesting side of the other side of this era. I'm not convinced that if you have only 2 hours and 10 minutes to devote to understanding this era, this is the best thing to see. Dana, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I'm going to be a dissenter there and say I would definitely send people to How to Survive a Plague before I would send them to this version. I mean, maybe I'm letting my aesthetic persnicketiness get in the way of being moved by this film. And some of the parts, especially the part where the Mark Ruffalo's character's lover contracts HIV and is getting sicker and sicker. I mean, there's some really, really tough scenes to take and some great performances, especially in the later half of this movie. But the thing that turned me off of this movie had nothing to do with the performances or the material for the most part. It had to do with the framing. You know, there would be things like 360-degree shots that would circle around an intense conversation of people debating something for no apparent reason. You know, or there'd be like a long tracking shot just cause. And I don't know, I just felt like there was a lot of directorial grandstanding and kind of gilding the lily in a way that this material was not allowed to stand and to be itself. And I guess that's something common with filmed plays, that because they tend to be static and talky, there's a sense that you have to jazz them up with a lot of camera movement. But there was something showy about the way this material was presented that turned me off.
Yeah, it made me wish that somebody had made a movie of it then. Like, if I'm going to appreciate it as a document of the moment, I wish it were more a document of the moment, because I felt so much of the last 20, 30 years of gay politics is layered into it. And in the current gay community, there's still conflict and discussion and division around the recent strategy of using gay marriage as the key vehicle through which to fight for gay rights. And it's been wildly successful. But the conflict is still there between the notion that you have to present gay love as, you know, just sort of the gay version of the same marriage that everybody has always wanted. And there are people within the gay community who feel like that compresses and deflates some of the things that were fascinating and non-normative about being gay, that were interesting and complicated and different. And I think with this movie, which concludes with a marriage, which concludes with a bunch of gay couples dancing cheek to cheek and something that is both a hopeful vision of the future and also totally ominous, because you think this is still 1983, half of this room is probably going to die, it complicates your argument that this should be a primary document of the time, because it's so infused with today's politics as well.
It's interesting to me to think about how this is being, how this movie particular is being responded to by especially young gay men. Brian Lauder and June Thomas had a really interesting back and forth on Howard Slate's gay blog about the movie. And reading Brian, who is a young gay man, you know, reading him made me feel both sort of glad that the world has moved on to the point where many of the concerns at play in this show are no longer at issue at all. But it also made me sad that Brian, and by his claim, many of his cohort in that age bracket, and sort of the millennial gay age bracket, view this specific fight as essentially not that relevant to them. Because I feel like way more than the marriage fight, which has been tremendously politically successful in changing laws around the country and in changing some attitudes, I think the Larry Kramer fight over AIDS in the 80s was just as important, or way more important, in putting the lives of gay men in the vision of the average American and forcing Americans to come to a reckoning as to whether they actually thought that the lives of these men were worth less than those of everyone else. And I thought that was the real triumph of this era. That was the real accomplishment of this era, which rivals anything I feel like that the gay marriage struggle has done.
All right. Well, the film is The Normal Heart on HBO. I think Dan and I would recommend that you check it out. Dana?
How to Survive a Plague.
All right. Or see the documentary How to Survive a Plague instead. Coming up, what makes a good commencement speech? And why are students so often dissatisfied with the speakers? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Julia Turner, along with Dana Stevens and Dan Coyce, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page, wmyc.org/gabfest. And please, leave a comment while you're there. That's wmyc.org/gabfest. All right, on to our next topic, commencement speeches. This is the time of year when commencement speeches are in the news. The recent graduation speeches have burst into the news. This year has been a wave of protests and withdrawals. The one that got the most buzz was Christine Lagarde, who's the head of the IMF, was scheduled to speak at Smith, but students protested, disapproving of some of the policies of the IMF and its work in developing countries. And eventually the protests gathered so much momentum that Christine Lagarde withdrew. So there's been a bit of Sturm und Drang about students and their unwillingness to sit down and listen to ideas that aren't necessarily their own. And I'm curious for your guys' take on that, and then also a little bit more generally to talk about the commencement speech as a form. But first, let's start with these protesters. Are you Team Lagarde or Team Smith protesters? Dana?
I think from what I know of that scandal, I would say I'm Team Lagarde. I mean, to my surprise, you know, they may have legitimate objections to the actions of the IMF. But I think if an all-women's college wants to get an extremely powerful woman on the world stage onto their podium to talk at commencement, they may have to put up with some, as you say, elements in her resume that don't jibe with the ideology of every student at Smith College. I think if she had, for example, performed some sort of offensive public act. I mean, I think somebody else was kicked off of a commencement speech because, you know, it was discovered that they had made all these racist, homophobic comments or possibly fired people for that reason. And I think then you're in a different zone. But if it's just that the person is politically powerful and has therefore had their fingers in something political or economic that you don't agree with, that's starting to push it.
Coyce, where are you?
I'm Team Lagarde, but I'm also Team feeling like the commencement speakers at colleges where students have applied pressure then yelling at them for doing that at commencement, as the president of Swarthmore, for example, did, is like a little bit tacky. I feel like we want the commencement to be sort of above this issue. Like, let someone come in and deliver their platitudes. Maybe you will learn something from them. Maybe you will hate them. Maybe you will protest. Either way, it's going to be fine. Then using your bully pulpit to yell at the students for being immature is like, the point has sort of escaped you.
Oh, why not? I don't know. It's your last moment to instruct them. And I feel like the whole point or the whole issue at the heart of these protests to me, or the thing that galls me about it, is, you know, there is this sense, the common complaint, that higher education has become more of a consumer service where it's all about pleasing the students and giving them what they want. And
the parents, of course. You got to have somebody fancy at the commencement so the parents feel like their dollars are well spent.
But those are in opposition. That's the problem, is the parents want Christine Lagarde, but the students want to rebel against their parents and the university, and they don't want her.
All right. Well, I think we're all sufficiently agreed on this issue that perhaps we should move on in general to the subject of commencement speeches. Dan, who spoke at your commencement? How hungover were you? And what did you make of the whole thing?
Seamus Heaney spoke.
Oh, nice. That's a good one.
It was a good one. There were no protests about Seamus Heaney. He had not yet issued his translation of Beowulf, so no Old English scholars could take issue with it.
Did he have a mellifluous Irish accent?
He, as far as I can remember, in fact, that's the only thing I remember, is his mellifluous Irish accent. I don't remember any of the words he said. Don't remember anything else about it other than that it was totally unobjectionable and lovely and very lulling. It was a sunny day. We were out in Keenan Stadium at the University of North Carolina, and I dozed off on a number of occasions. It seemed great.
The mark of a good commencement speech is that it's soothing and lulling to doze to. It basically has a lot in common with a lullaby.
I feel like all of us in that stadium were pretty tired at that point. And so that was nice. It was nice, I thought. Julia, who did you have?
There were a couple different speakers, but the one I remember best is a man named Gustavo Gutierrez, who's a Peruvian priest who was basically one of the founders of liberation theology. And it was a harangue. I mean, I still remember it. He yelled at all of us, basically, and was like, you privileged snots, you better do something good with your lives or else you're a stupid waste of money, resources, and time. He said it more nicely than this, but it was, like, vehement and forceful. I felt charged with import and purpose. It was great. I liked
getting... I mean, so that's great.
I liked getting yelled at. I thought it was great.
Right.
I did not... I would say journalism is good work, but not the most direct good work you can do in the world. And I sometimes think about that, and I often think about Gustavo Gutierrez when I do. Although I did have to Google his name before the segment. I remembered being yelled at by a liberation theologist, but not which one specifically.
That's a feeling
that
stays
clearly,
with you.
Clearly, if the trend is away from the, say, Christine Lagarde's on one side and the Gustavo Gutierrez's on the other side, because surely he would also engender protest of some sort, not liberal protest maybe, but conservative protest, we're going to end up with graduation speakers like the one who my poor brother-in-law had at his graduation. It was the winter graduation, not the spring graduation, the winter graduation from the University of Maryland, and they had Boomer Esiason.
I'm sorry, I don't know who that is. Who's Boomer Esiason?
He is a ex-Cincinnati Bengals quarterback and current NFL analyst.
And so what did he say?
Nothing. He said, like, go team. Like, he said nothing. He said nothing. And so it's like, it was, you know, it's like, so I feel like the protest against anyone possibly interesting is just going to lead you down the path of Boomer Esiason eventually.
Which is trouble because the form itself has a tendency to make interesting people boring.
It's a terrible literary format, which is why I think you have to be a great writer in order to do it. When I think of great commencement speeches, I think of the George Saunders speech, which is, I think, maybe last year or so, the last couple of years, and I can't remember what school he was speaking at, but it was a beautiful piece of writing that actually did contain a lot of life wisdom, but was somehow not sententious at all. David Foster Wallace's famous speech at Kenyon College, I think it was, is also a fantastic piece of writing. But it seems like they were aiming for something a little bit different than let me give counsel to these young people. And maybe that was what made the counsel worthwhile.
I mean, I think the format that the successful ones actually have the most in common with is a sermon, right? But the people who are asked to give these speeches are the Christine Lagardes of the world who don't have a lot of experience writing that. And so when you get an actual thinking writer who can kind of pull off the transition from story to transcendent moment, then you get something that has the same kind of elevation that a good sermon could deliver. But that's a tricky mode to be writing in.
And I just wonder if, like, the students at George Saunders's graduation, if they recognized how great it was.
Right, because something lives on the page doesn't mean it lived on the podium by any means. But I do think
even that it lives on that it dies on the podium doesn't mean that it can't live later as a viral video or book. Like that's the format in which the commencement speech works now.
Well,
not
maybe,
as a commencement speech.
Maybe that can save it. Maybe those innovations in the format can attract people to it to do interesting things with it.
Well, so that's a great question. So if it elevates the form enough that great writers might do it, do either of you have like a dream writer who you would actually pay to attend a commencement that had a commencement speech by?
It's so hard to imagine her doing any sort of TED Talk behind a podium, but Deborah Eisenberg, I'm sure, would come up with something completely awesome. Life wisdom from Deborah Eisenberg. That's what I want.
I was thinking Alice Munro, which is a similar vein, I think. So the topic is commencement speeches. If you drive around over the next few weeks, you may catch one on a campus near you. Also, there are reams of them online now, and we'll post links to some of the ones we like best and least. All right. For our final segment today, we're going to talk about the new 9/11 Museum, which just opened in New York. The museum has come in for some praise and some controversy since it opened, but I think also there are questions about what it means to curate and memorialize an experience as searing and shocking as the terrorist attack on 9/11. So I think we should just start with our experiences. Dan, what did you make of the museum when you visited last week?
I mean, one thing that really struck me almost immediately upon getting there, and I don't know, other people who visited maybe have had similar experiences, is that it's currently very popular. Just opened, there are big lines, and in fact, they have timed tickets so that I got there early in the morning and then waited in line half an hour just to get a ticket to come back much later in the day. But you're standing in line for this thing that by its own nature, I sort of didn't really actually want to be going to at all. But then next to you in line, there's this other line, like a fast lane, of other people who are just being escorted right up to the front, and they get to go right in. And of course, the natural human response to seeing someone else going faster than you in a line is, oh, that's not fair. I want to be in that line. But then I realize, oh, that's the line for all the people who lost people in 9/11. So actually, I don't want to be in that line at all. But so that just was the first of any number of totally surreal and discomforting and weird, awful experiences of being in this museum, which honestly, my takeaway of it is I cannot understand why anyone would ever want to go to this museum ever in a million years.
All right. So not a rave review from Tim.
I'm laying it out there.
No, I agree with you about the fundamental weirdness of museumizing the place. I mean, the first thing that happens after you get into the museum with your time ticket is that you go through security, which causes you to think about why there's such intense security on that site in particular and all the security lines you've ever stood in the years since 9/11. Stana, what were you struck by this morning?
Well, the presence of security is something that struck me for sure. To me, there was a feeling, you know, a slightly police state feeling from the moment you enter the ground. So there's a little bit of a feeling of anxiety before you even go in. And then something that struck me about the museum that I think is actually a strength of its design, but that I agree with Dan is a real downer for people going to see it, is that the more you get into the museum, the further you get underground. So there's no natural light. You're descending down this ramp past these projected reconstructions of the posters that people put up around New York in the days after 9/11 looking for so-and-so. You know, so you're already descending into this space of grief. And by the time you get to the bottom, I don't know, I just felt like I was in a lightless trap. There's something very anxiety producing about the design of the museum, which is, you know, I think was maybe part of the plan, but does not seem to me like something that's going to be pulling tourists in.
Although it was packed with tourists and people wearing their cute, like, crop top tourist outfits for their days in New York City. I mean, I had the moment this morning, I'm wearing bright red pants, where I was like, should I not wear bright red pants to the 9/11 museum? And I was like, it's a museum. I can wear whatever I want to the museum. These are my pants that are clean. I'm going to wear them. But it is, you know, you find yourself checking out everybody else and wondering about their motives for being there, because obviously they can be very personal or, you know, more general. I lived in New York at the time and had my own various connections to it, even though I didn't lose anybody in it. And, you know, we're totally abstract. People who are like, hey, I'm here from, you know, 5,000 miles away, click, take a picture of me in front of the waterfall, click, take me a picture of me in front of One World Trade, click, here I am underground trying to understand this thing. And I don't know, Dan, I don't begrudge them trying to understand what it was like. I don't know if I would go. I think if I were in Germany, I would probably...
If you were in Germany, you would go to Auschwitz, but that was 70 years ago. My main argument with the existence of the museum is that simply it feels to me, and not to pull out an old hoary phrase, but it feels too soon to museumize this specific event and to do it in the actual place where it happened. Like, this is a museum that I feel like should exist 50 years from now so that future generations will have a sense of what went on, but also so that it can be more easily and comprehensively contextualized and dealt with in a way that isn't beholden to any number of different very legitimate and deserving interest groups who have specific interests in the way that the information in this museum is presented.
Yeah, I think a key word that you just used, Dan, was context. And I think it's something that this museum lacks in some important ways and provides in others. But let's talk about what actually happens when you descend down into this pit that is essentially the foundation of the original building.
One of the most striking moments actually is where there's a placard that says, here in this very spot that you are standing between you and the facing wall is where the bomb exploded in the garage of the World Trade Center in 1993. This is the actual site underground of that explosion. I found that to be one of the most startling and striking situating moments as you start to walk down this ramp and you see, you know, some of the columns that were used in the building's construction. You see the slurry wall that was not destroyed on the day of the attacks. You begin to get a sense of the scope and the space underground.
I also found those interesting. I found the survivor stairs that they've transported down totally fascinating to see and to visualize. But at the same time, that was part of what in the end struck me as the problematic issue with this museum, is that basically half the museum underneath the footprint of one tower is devoted to memorializing the victims. And that part is beautiful and extremely well done and very touching. But then the other half is a extremely well done, high quality, interactive museum exhibit that is meant to recreate what September 11th was like on a moment-by-moment basis as it was lived by all the people who lived through it. And that, to me, is like maddening in and how manipulative it is, and how misguided an impulse I feel like it is. You know, I feel like to descend into that second section, the 9/11 moment by moment section, I was miserable the entire time, and maybe I should have been miserable. I guess I should have been miserable, but I don't know that that is the way that anyone is going to get the most out of this kind of experience. And so, you know, being in a museum space that had little alcoves you could go into if you had the courage to watch people jump from the towers.
I did not go in that alcove. Could you go in that alcove, Julia?
I went in that alcove, but I could not go in the alcove that had audio recordings of people calling from the top of the burning building who could not get out and were leaving voicemail messages for their wives. I couldn't go in that alcove. But so to be in the space and then to look over to one side and see that as an architectural feature of this museum exhibit, there are pillars filled with Kleenexes. Like, that just drove me insane and made me so unhappy. And when I got on the escalator to get up out of this space, and they were playing Amazing Grace over the speakers as I went up the escalator, I realized that, like, my whole body was completely tensed up, and one of my arms, like, had severe muscle pain from where I was, like, gripping my bag with an iron grip the entire time. And so I guess, in a way, all of this is appropriate. I should feel this way about 9/11, but I already did feel this way about 9/11. I don't know anyone who doesn't feel this way about 9/11, and I had no connection to it whatsoever. And so the idea of someone, for example, who was caught up in this event or who lost a loved one in this event strikes me as just the most awful, terrible thing I can imagine. And I know that they say it's been specifically designed not to create trauma in survivors. How do they know?
Somehow your vehemence about this museum is launching in me a feeling of wanting to defend the museum. I felt that there should be something to memorialize what that day was like. Everyone experienced it in different ways. The people visiting from 5,000 miles away experienced it very remotely. People around the world saw, and that caused them to connect with this city, and it makes sense that they would want to come here and sort of understand it more closely. And I think that the museum is very sensitive about the fact that the day has many meanings for many people. And I basically thought the museum was very well done. I don't think I would have gone if it weren't for this segment, but I thought it was very well done.
I agree that it is well done, but that doesn't mean that I think it should exist. Like, and so you're right that it does. There are many points in the museum where sort of a visitor's point of entry to the museum is this notion not of the lived experience of being in the middle of 9/11, but of the way that almost everyone else on Earth experienced it, right? You walk down the ramp and you get video of and audio of people saying, oh, I woke up in Melbourne and it was on the news, or my family called me and said, turn on the TV or whatever. And it's everyone talking about what their experiences were and of witnessing this event. And I sort of reject the notion that this matters. Like, I don't think that my experience of 9/11, for example, to pick a random person out of thin air, should matter even a tiny bit compared to the experiences of the people who were actually killed there. I think that making a museum that is essentially designed to raise my experiences to the level of, oh, this was something that we all experienced together, is like sort of fundamentally insulting to what was the ultimate horror of 9/11, which was that it was the end for all these people in a way that they never could have imagined. And everything else, I feel like, is essentially extraneous to that. And that's why, to my mind, I agree with you that something needs to be there, but that something is there. It's the memorials. 50 years from now, I will be, you know, not delighted, but I will grudgingly accept that a museum is there to interpret those events and to contextualize them for the world. But right now, it feels like it's just like not a necessary thing.
I guess, Dan, I don't understand why you're the arbiter of when this museum gets to exist, right? Like,
I'm not, obviously.
You know, but your argument is like, it's
shut it down. Coyce doesn't like it.
It's too soon. 50 years would be a fine time to do it. And I think it's been done very sensitively. You don't have to go. Nobody has to go. But I think it's been done basically as sensitively as you could do it. But I don't begrudge this museum for existing. All right, now is the moment in our show when we endorse. Dana, what have you got to endorse today?
I'm going to endorse Penciltopia, which is this group that teaches children to do stop-motion animation. I learned about Penciltopia because they move from school to school. They do different after-school programs. I think you can also take private lessons through them. I'm pretty sure it's a countrywide thing. And my daughter's school had a Penciltopia class this year that she participated in, and she learned to do claymation. And we just got to go see the screening of all the kids' claymation movies. They're incredibly delightful and fun. And you can go to the Penciltopia website and look at – I don't think my daughter's class is up there yet, but you can look at years' worth of children's stop-motion animation and claymation videos, and they're completely fun. So go to penciltopia.blogspot.com to look at some of those.
That sounds great. I thought Penciltopia was going to be another June Thomas approved pencil podcast, but I will accept stop motion animation class as well.
The war of the pencil podcasts, the ratings war is huge.
Dan, do you have an endorsement for us today?
I do. I have an essay in the new issue of The Common, which is a literary journal based in Amherst. The essay is called Bud. It's by a writer named Nalini Jones. It is a very sad and sweet essay about Jones's mostly epistolary friendship with an unnamed American folk musician. It's made up mostly of the letters that he sends her through his disappointing career, which tapers off because of his alcoholism, and it ends with his death.
Is The Common? I haven't read The Common much, but I've seen them. It's a beautifully designed magazine. Should I be reading it as well as looking at it?
It's very good, and it's like the most handsome literary journal around, for sure. And this piece is really nice. You can read the whole thing online, so you can check it out.
All right, I will.
Julia, what are you endorsing today?
Dan, my endorsement today was inspired by you, in a way. It is a book that I first read in the Slate Book Review, but the book is Wild by Cheryl Strayed. It's her memoir of hiking the Pacific Crest Trail while woefully unprepared for doing so in the mid-90s, and it is just so gripping. I've had one of those stretches. Have you ever had one of those stretches for a few months where no book truly grabs you and you kind of don't finish them and you feel unmoored by your inability to get deeply into a written text?
Yep.
I had that feeling finally, that joyous feeling of falling in love with reading again, where I just could not put this book down. I wanted to ignore everything in my life to just consume word after word of it. Highly recommend it. I'm sure you've heard about it or seen it kicking around on your friends' coffee tables, but if you haven't yet, pick it up and actually read the thing. It's great. Well, that's our show. Thanks, Dana.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, guys.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wmyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or in the WMYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate GabFest. GabFest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman, Mike Volo, and Chris Wade. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, I'm Julia Turner. We'll talk to you next week. I just wanna be